don't even have to judge yourself. Just do your best.
We need diversity. We need differences. And I absolutely agree. What becomes a bit problematic is that sometimes those differences and that diversity, in theory, sounds fantastic. In practice, it gets a little bit muddled. I remember my first kind of brush up against this when I was 17, and it was at the end of a fast and testimony meeting, and I had been struggling for a while with gender roles and how to fit in and feel like I belonged. And after a very trying week at girls' camp and an epiphany of sorts, which is also code for sleep deprivation, I was very happy that I had found a way to somehow be myself without falling into the mold that was expected. And I shared this excitement in a fast and testimony meeting, and it was a moment that I felt like, I can make this work. I'm going to fit in. I'm going to be accepted for who I am. And after that meeting was over, I had a young woman, a leader, pull me aside and say, what you just did is an affront to all of the women in the ward. You said that you didn't have to follow the traditional expectations and you didn't have to necessarily stay at home and raise kids. You just offended everyone who chose that. And so as a 17-year-old, oh, the weight of that was just awful. Did we lose that? We did. We're okay? Oh, okay. And so then later on, fast forward to my early 20s, and I've been studying martial arts at this point now, today, for about 20 years, but I was only about 5 years in, and a huge fan of Thai kickboxing. That's where I began, went on to get a black belt in Taekwondo and Kung Fu, and in my early 20s, I wanted to work with the young women and do a self-defense class. And I was told, that's not feminine for our young ladies, and we don't think that that's appropriate activity. Fast forward to now, where a young Mormon kickboxing mother is highlighted in Meet the Mormons. And so this idea of where diversity is and how we accept it is difficult. The last story I'll tell, and then I promise I'll let you do your thing, is when I was working on my PhD, I did fieldwork in Haiti, and I was understanding and looking at Mormon missionary efforts that had happened in Haiti and how that connected with the very cultural practice of voodoo and how they sort of work and help and come together in ways that are unexpected. And the missionaries that I were interviewing there were a couple of missionaries that were French-speaking from Canada, and they said, we don't get these Haitians. You know, we ask them why the Book of Mormon is true, and they tell us because they've had visions. I mean, that's crazy talk. Like, they're always getting visions, and that kind of stuff never happens to us. The idea being that if it were going to happen to anyone, wouldn't it be the white and delightsome young missionaries? Not necessarily. The Haitians swear and are very, very steadfast in their belief that it is through visions and bodily experience that they come to understand the truth of the church. So having said that, I'm very interested to hear about this diversity and pluralism, and thank you, Christopher.
I'll go ahead and move this over a little closer to the mic. The Sunstone community knows a little something about pluralism. Richard Pohl's classic talk, What the Church Means to People Like Me, describes a certain kind of pluralism within Mormonism.
He describes Liahona Mormons and Iron Rod Mormons. How many of you are familiar with this talk already? Liahona Mormon essentially uses primarily the guidance of individual inspiration and revelation, like a compass, following a compass through a track that you don't already know, where an iron rod Mormon sees a track already laid out, grasps the iron rod, and goes directly to it. If you're not familiar with it, I definitely recommend it. Now, unfortunately, despite Pohl's explicit warning that he is not talking about good black Mormons, some self-described Liahona Mormons, and I would consider myself among the Liahona Mormons, take him to mean that Liahona Mormons are the real true Mormons and the other guys are all fundamentalists. And I've probably been guilty of this myself on occasion. Sometimes approaches in the Sunstone community and similar communities tend to really focus on pluralism and diversity, even sometimes with a certain intolerance of our own. And we often neglect the scriptural call to unity. Doctrine and Covenants 38:27, I say unto you, be one, and if you're not one, you're not mine. Now, I'm confident that we can find many more scriptural exhortations to unity than to diversity or pluralism. In fact, I think that in Mormon cosmology, pluralism is the base state of the world. And God's purposes include unifying us in the face of that pluralism. I think this is the implication of Joseph Smith's famous statement from the King Follett Discourse. God never had the power to create the spirit of man at all. God himself could not create himself. It is intelligence is eternal and exists upon a self-existent principle. It is a spirit from age to age, and there is no creation about it. All the minds God ever sent into the world are susceptible of enlargement. The first principles of man are self-existent with God. God himself, finding he was in the midst of spirits and glory, because he was more intelligent, saw proper to institute laws whereby the rest could have a privilege to advance like himself. In other words, the gods find themselves in the midst of plurality and seek to bind us to them and to each other in unifying covenants to cooperate in the divine purposes. Does this mean that pluralism is undesirable or something to be conquered? Renowned physicist in his book Infinite in All Directions makes this statement that really resonates with me. Diversity is for me the chief source of beauty and value in the natural universe around us, in the governance of human societies, and in the depths of our individual souls. The profusion of stars and galaxies in our skies, the profusion of bugs and beetles in our gardens, and the profusion of human genius in our arts and sciences all proclaim that God loves diversity. Diversity is the spice of life, and the prevalence of evil in our world is the price we pay for diversity. Now, Mormons would probably modify that last statement to say that the prevalence of evil in our world chose in the premortal council to pay for agency. But agency itself implies at least a diversity of individuals, desires, and centers of power. So diversity is at the heart of agency. And within our most sacred spaces, our temples, we're taught that the creators of our world intended to give variety to the face of the earth. I believe God loves diversity, but not chaos. Mormonism seems to contain within itself the seeds of valuing both diversity and unity. And perhaps this is the underlying source of one of the paradoxes of Mormonism Terrell Gibbons identified in his excellent book, People of Paradox. The paradoxical tension in Mormonism between authority and agency. And what are we to make of that tension? Are unity and diversity incompatible values? Now, if we think of it perhaps in a strict binary sense of one versus many, we could argue that they are. But I think we can understand these concepts as complementary to each other and that we have scriptural and prophetic warrant to do so. Now, I want to rely a little bit on some recent comments from LDS leaders that promote not only a permissibility of pluralism within Mormonism, but its desirability. So on the permissibility front, Dietrich Christofferson gave an interview to Daniel Woodruff of KUTV recently, and Daniel Woodruff asked the question, can members of the church support gay marriage that the church teaches against? Elder Christofferson's response was, well, there is a diversity of opinion in that regard, and that's always been true on many subjects over the years, over the decades, and we don't have qualms of that. Dieter F. Uchtdorf went far beyond that in an April 2013 General Conference address. And he said, "But while the atonement is meant to help us all become more like Christ, it is not meant to make us all the same. Sometimes we confuse differences in personality. We can even make the mistake of thinking that because someone is different from us, it must mean they are not pleasing to God. This line of thinking leads some to believe that the church wants to create every member from a single mold, that each one should look, feel, think, and behave like every other. This would contradict the genius of God, who has created every man different from his brother, every son different from his father. Even identical twins are not identical in their personalities and spiritual identities. It also contradicts the intent and purpose of the Church of Jesus Christ, which acknowledges and protects the moral agency with all its far-reaching consequences for each and every one of God's children. As disciples of Jesus Christ, we are united in our testimony of the restored gospel and our commitment to keep God's commandments, but we are diverse in our cultural, social, and political preferences. The church thrives when we take advantage of this diversity and encourage each other to develop and use our talents to lift and strengthen our fellow disciples." Now, this is great for those of us who find ourselves in the minority in our congregations, or at least here in Utah in our neighborhoods. But it is easy to read this in isolation as requiring the majority to accept us as we are. And in doing so, we may miss the growth that comes from striving for unity. Indeed, Jesus' great intercessory prayer in John 17 seems to describe unity as the ultimate goal and perhaps even the effectuation of salvation. "Neither pray I for these alone, but also for them which shall believe on their words, that they may all be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them, that they may be one even as we are one, I in them and thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one." So we must be one, but not all the same. Just as in Mormonism, the Godhead is one, but not all the same. So what I'd like to talk about through the rest of my discussion here is a metaphor that helps us to think about unity that is not sameness, and that metaphor is music. I have sung choral music most of my life. Sorry. Unity that is not sameness. Yes, not sameness. So I've sung choral music for most of my life, beginning with a ward choir when I was a boy soprano. To today, I'm the choir director in my ward, and my wife and I sing a Baroque ensemble. I'd like to illustrate a few ways in which music can illuminate our thinking about how we function as a church in harmony, which is a kind of unity that is not sameness. The simplest form of Western sacred music, and Western sacred music is what I am most familiar with, and so it forms the backbone of most of my musical illustrations. The simplest form is unison. Early sacred music was chant, plain chant, or Gregorian chant, you may have heard of. And I'm going to play an example of this.
Tu sei vivo, mi risponde.
So this is unity through sameness. And while that is very beautiful, I also find that if I listen to it for a long time, I lose interest, because diversity and novelty are a primary source of interest. But it can be exciting, and it can get us into a different state of mind. And we can think of other times when sameness may be a virtue. For example, some months ago, the church released a video about temple clothing. And one of the points that was made in this video is that dressing in similar white clothing in the temple puts everyone there on an equal plane. And so it erases, at least ideally, the ecclesiastical or the economic hierarchies that obtain outside the temple. So there's a value there in sameness. The simplest and earliest form of Western sacred music. The next development was called organ, which is a melody that's sung over a continuous note. And here's an example of what that sounds like. So it's not a whole lot more interesting than the first one, but there is a step there, and out of this later evolved basso continuo, or just continuo, which I'll talk about a bit later on. Now there's something I think that we can grab onto there with that continuo, this idea of that continuity. You could hear in that piece of music that while that drone, that lower note, was the same throughout, as the melody above went through different notes and different modulations, that there were times when it came in tension. It comes in tension with that lower note. Introducing an additional voice starts to introduce the concept of tension in music. And that continuo ties that diversity that was introduced in a very simple form into this continuity that holds the piece together. After this form came what we have as our most familiar form of polyphony in sacred music, which is essentially harmony like we're accustomed to in the hymns. And this is where voice parts are different, but they mostly move together, and they mostly move in very consonant ways, in ways that fit together. And we'll play a sample from Vaughan Williams, a very renowned British composer. You may recognize the tune. Now, this introduction of multiple parts starts to introduce some new musical ideas. The idea of tonality and the idea that there are consonances, notes that sound good together, and dissonances, notes that rub uncomfortably against each other, and they beg for a resolution to consonants. This is where our metaphor of cognitive dissonance comes from, is this sound that provides a tension that we want resolution for. And you heard some examples in there of that, and I'll give some examples on the keyboard in a minute. I did want to bring up one other example of where Western sacred music went after this type of polyphony, and that's counterpoint. In counterpoint, there are complementary but unique melodic lines, and they interweave with different rhythms. They start at different times, they have different structures. One might be a rising pattern, another a falling pattern. There may be some repetition in one area, there might be a part that is doing a chorale with moving parts over it. And those are all still within the tonal constraints of the piece, but it's a very different style. And I'll play an example from Bach, who was the master of this type of counterpoint. So you hear all of those individual parts moving, both is with different vocal parts coming in and playing off of each other, but also in the instrumentation, where you hear some of those solo instruments also playing against the voices. And this type of structure in music provides many, many more opportunities for dissonance and for resolution through the course of the piece than when all of the voices are moving together in simple harmonic polyphony. It opens up many, many more possibilities as well, symbolically and structurally, harmonically and rhythmically. And one example of a structural thing that can be done is a fugue. You all are familiar, I'm sure, with this piece. Okay, so there you hear the same piece being, the same theme being picked up by different voices, by the left hand, by the right hand of the organ, by the pedals of the organ. All of these repeating over and running that same theme, and that's a fugue. There's a balance, though, that now ends up needing to be struck between the multiplied possibilities of multiple independent voices and the coordination of the voices. There was a British composer named Thomas Tallis who wrote a piece called Spem in Allium, which is written for 40 individual voices. He took his inspiration, I think, from a visiting Italian composer, kind of took it on as a challenge to write this piece for 40 individual voices. I'm going to play a couple of clips from this, and you'll notice at the beginning of the piece, as a few voices start out, that they're very distinct. Then I'm going to skip forward to the point where you have all 40 voices singing together. Come together in unity at the end. As those independent voices are moving, sometimes quite muddled until voices start to move together and not quite so independently. This might be more like what we could experience in a diverse ward in the church, and it does suggest that there are some limits to the desirability of diversity. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the particular techniques that we've heard in some of these pieces that I think have some metaphorical relevance to our participation in the work of God. And some of the metaphorical application I'm sure you will come up with on your own. The first one that I want to talk about is what are called suspended chords. Suspension is a form of dissonance that's created by timing. a part of a chord moves before or after the other parts of a chord. Let me give you an example. Another example where you can play a suspended where you have a leading tone, where the piece is, the moving part is actually ahead of the rest of the chord, and the rest of the chord joins in after the fact. Okay? And these types of suspensions are really about how these pieces move in time. And similarly, each of us moves with respect to the body of the church with variations in timing. I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. Another common technique is to play one chord on top of a bass note that is part of a different chord. Something like this. Where this is a G chord on the top over an F note on the bottom. Okay, that's a very common technique of using two chords together, and this creates a kind of a dissonance, but it can often be very pleasant and very strong, particularly when both of these chords that you're using are relatively dominant. That is, they're both ones that are leading back toward the resolution of the chord. So very strong would be... Okay, that's a strong resolution from the G chord to a C chord. Or one that's more familiar maybe in some sacred music, is an F chord, right? The Amen, right? Okay? And so those chords against each other, or this way, are often used because both of those are very dominant. When you use less dominant chords that don't lead you as much to the resolution, the dissonance and the tension is much more challenging. We often think about dissonance with negative connotations, but the dissonance can really be used to create some incredibly, incredibly beautiful sounds. I just want to play a couple of clips from a couple of different pieces that rely on this dissonance very heavily to create beautiful music. Here's another example that uses this dissonance to lift the entire piece as you go. So one of the things that I think this metaphor does really well, when we talk about music as a metaphor for unity and pluralism in the church, is that it's something that is recognizable and understandable and welcomed and accepted by both the quote-unquote Liahona Mormons and the Mormons. This is something that I think really can be viewed and help us understand the value of both sides of this apparent dichotomy. So this resolution is when those dissonances that we hear turn to consonance, and this usually brings a sense of relief and completion to the listener. But it's not always required. It can be deferred for a long time. We heard a lot of that in those passages in the last piece that I played. Now, in some cases, a composer will deliberately not resolve a chord or fulfill a musical expectation. Now, if I did that with a familiar tune, many of you will probably be bothered by this, right? So if I do... If I leave it there, everybody kind of goes, yeah, play that last. No, right? We want that to happen. But it can also be used to great effect. And I don't want to play just the very ending of another piece listen for how the composer has deliberately left this last chord unresolved. Hear that dissonance that just brings that out, and it creates this pull, and often leaving that dissonance unresolved can create a forward-leaning pull in our music. And I think this can apply very often in our own experiences in life as well. A couple of other interesting things there, just kind of tangential, but one thing to note about music is that one key signature can be either major or minor, for example. That's the key of C, no sharps or flats, but that same key is A minor. And one chord can be interpreted in multiple equally valid ways. A famous example of this is from Wagner, who famous Tristan chord. I'll just see if I can get this to play here. So this chord, it's a very open chord, and musicians, professional musicians, disagree about how this chord should be interpreted, how it fits into the tonal structure overall, how it should be labeled, what it should be called. And quite fascinating that we hear the same thing, and yet there are multiple and often equally valid interpretations. Now, obviously, I'm not the first person to think of this metaphor of music for unity and pluralism in the church. In fact, as I prepared for the presentation, I discovered that in 2013, Rosalind Welch wrote a blog post titled "Singing in 10,000 Part Harmony" that relies on precisely this same metaphor. While I obviously like this, Sam Brunson at By Common Consent responded in a slightly different vein just last month. And he said this, "I love Rosalind's metaphor, while at the same time I find myself pushing back a little. In part, it's because I don't love choral music, because I find it, even with its 10,000 parts, too restrictive. My preferred metaphor is the free jazz ensemble. See, in a choir, you sing the music that is written. And I'm not convinced that our lives are written. Instead, I believe that we're improvising as we go along. Now, I agree with Sam that our own parts are improvised to a great degree, but I don't think that that's in strict contrast to the choral metaphor any more than unity and diversity are in strict contrast. Something many people don't realize about the Baroque period in particular, of which Bach is the quintessential composer, is that improvisation played a very large role. Bach himself was a consummate improviser, and he often sketched out a bass figure or a set of chords for his performers to improvise on. Now, this played out in a couple of ways. First, the concept of basso continuo, which I mentioned earlier, in which chords were indicated, but this was typically played by a keyboardist, and then the keyboardist would improvise the notes and the full figuration of the accompaniment. And second, during some movements of Bach's works, accompaniment would pause at places to allow for a cadenza, which is a free improvisation by the featured voice. This is typically solo improvisation, unlike the free jazz improvisation that Sam mentions, which tend to be group improvisation, but the principle holds. Sam continued in saying, improvisation, even free jazz improvisation, we can do whatever we want. What it does mean is it is our job as the players to listen to everyone around us, to figure out what they're doing and how we fit in. While there's no tight structure, there is a loose structure, and we're responsible for making sure that what we create makes sense. We each pick and choose what notes and rhythms and timbre we're going to use, and those notes and rhythms and timbres we choose tonight may well differ from the ones chosen by our co-religionists, and in fact, to make the performance interesting, they should differ. But we all ultimately draw from the same palette of notes. The music of our free jazz lives and religion isn't always easy to listen to. It can be dissonant, tremendously so even, and sometimes what we try doesn't work. But there's always tomorrow night, another chance to try to play with and against each other, to try to walk the tightrope and create something collectively that's greater than what we could have created individually. Beautiful. Now, clearly others have employed the same concept. Emma Luthain and Laurel Thatcher Ulrich wrote a book called All God's Critters Got a Place in the Choir, taking its title from a traditional folk song whose origins are obscure. We find a similar metaphor in the New Testament, the body of Christ. For as the body is one and hath many members, and all the members of that one body are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit are we all baptized into one body, whether we be Jews or Gentiles, whether we be bond or free, and have all been made to drink into one Spirit. For the body is not one member, but many. If the foot shall say, because I am not the hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear shall say, because I am not the eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where were the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where were the smelling? But now hath God set the members, every one of them, in the body, as it hath pleased him. And if they were all one member, where were the But now are they many members, yet one body. Now Paul is emphasizing the diversity of the members of the body, yet it is but one body. And a bit further on, he explains what this unity is. God hath tempered the body together, having given more abundant honor to that part which lacked, that there should be no schism in the body, but that the members should have the same care one for another. And whether one member suffer, all the members suffer with it, or one member be honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now ye are the body of Christ, and members in particular. In other words, unity comes in unity of and love, that we are willing to bear one another's burdens, that they may be light, yea, and are willing to mourn with those that mourn, yea, and comfort those that stand in need of comfort. Our surrounding culture emphasizes diversity and individualism, and with good reason. Too often the head says to the feet, I have no need of thee. But if in our concern for the oppressed we lose sight of our essential unity, if, for example, the feet reply to the head, I have no need of thee, we may have won the battle but lost the war. We are like the instruments of an orchestra or voices in a choir. We have our individual parts with freedom to improvise and interpret, with dissonances and consonances. We should also have a conductor who is God, but who invites us to help conduct, and as we learn the ways of divinity, to help compose. If we return for a moment to John 17, neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they may be one even as we are one, I in them and thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one. Now, this Greek term perfect indicates wholeness and completeness, teleos. It has the sense of accomplishing a goal, teleology. It's about purpose. We teach that the Godhead is united in purpose, and I suggest that this goes much deeper than we often make it appear on the surface. In 2012, a conference was held at BYU titled Exploring Mormon Conceptions of the Apostasy. The proceedings of this conference were published last year by Oxford University Press in Standing Apart, Mormon Historical Consciousness and the Concept of Apostasy. It's an excellent book that I wholeheartedly recommend. And in this volume, David D. Peck looks beyond Mormonism, specifically to Islam, to describe what he calls covenantal pluralism, including the idea, which seems to me to be consonant with the Book of Mormon, that God works with all nations of the earth, that God establishes various covenants with various peoples at various times. And he frames this diversity, especially in a Mormon context, within an overarching unity, a unity in God's purposes, in the teleology, in establishing covenants, and overarching thematic and hierarchical unity among the covenants. The concept that he gives of the eventual divine resolution of hierarchical covenants can be profitably applied to the way we think about pluralism within the church. Peck points out that we have in the church the concept of preparatory covenants, such as baptism, that precede level than subsequent covenants, such as temple ordinances. And I would suggest that the same approach can go beyond covenants. God can work with us where we are individually as much as with where nations are collectively. And our trust is that there will be resolution in the end. So for some examples of how this might work at an individual level, and going back to this idea of suspended cords and timing, some members were ahead of the body of the church with regard to the issue of blacks and the priesthood. The cord of Mormonism resolved in their direction. In other cases, people might be behind the body of the church. For example, with some of the fundamentalist polygamists, on to a change after the church had resolved to a different cord. But with this acknowledgement that God works with us individually, we must also remember that God's work can only be accomplished communally, no matter how good a soloist any of us might be. As we rehearse, we may need to rehearse different parts of the song at different times, and I may struggle with a different part than you struggle with. But we should be working on the same work, which is a magnum opus, with new movements being written as we go. The broader text of the call to unity in the Doctrine and Covenants repeats the concept from Mosiah of what our unity should mean. Let every man esteem his self and practice virtue and holiness before me. And again I say unto you, let every man esteem his brother as himself. For what man among you, having 12 sons, and is no respecter of them, and they serve him obediently? And he saith unto the one, Be thou clothed in robes, and sit thou here. And to the other, Be thou clothed in rags, and sit thou there. And looketh upon his sons, and saith, I am just. Behold, this I have given unto you as a parable, and it is even as I am. I say unto you, Be one, and if ye are not one, ye are not mine. Our unity must come from mutual esteem. In the famous words of Peter Meiderlin, in essentials, in non-essentials, liberty, in all things, charity. So what are the essentials? Long before Rosalind Welch or I or any other blogger turned to this metaphor, the Book of Mormon raised this question. If ye have felt to sing the song of redeeming love, I would ask, can ye feel so now? We should be singing the song of redeeming love. What is the song of redeeming love? Not just the song of love, the song of redeeming love. I believe this is the teleology of redeeming love, building Zion and transforming ourselves, each other, and this world into a celestial glory, expanding from there into newly created worlds and doing the same, worlds without end. Thank you. Oh, Chad, you're going?
So, I love the metaphor, and I think it's something that makes some of these things, the concept, more powerful in the Lord. So I think it's actually how we can potentially repurpose what we said here to people in our neighborhood, Lord, family, etc. What do you think is
so, for the recording, the question is, you know, the metaphor is nice. What does it mean in practical terms, and particularly as we, you know, participate in our communities and help to persuade others of this value? How can we use this metaphor in a practical way? Well, I would say one of them is just about things in this way. I think that the recognition of the ways in which Mormonism and Christianity already think about complexities of unity and pluralism, for example, within the Godhead, within the body of Christ that we have in the New Testament, that we can leverage those and that shared belief, that shared authority structure. But I think also, you know, in talking about this song of love and exhibiting this, my experience is that by demonstrating the kind of love that is the unifier, that people are much more open and welcoming to the diversity that I would like to be able to exhibit. And so I would say from a practical perspective, the most important thing that we can do is to ensure that we are demonstrating that love to people who might otherwise be afraid or uncomfortable with the dissonances that we introduce. And I think also that in some cases we might need to recognize that resolutions of dissonances, sometimes those dissonances resolve in the way that we would like, and sometimes we need to be willing to be the ones to move to make a resolution, at least temporarily, maybe in that contrapuntal sense where on our journey we come together. Maybe it's not our final stopping point, but we have to be willing to make some of those moves as well. What's the guarantee that there's going to be a resolution? I don't think there is a guarantee. I think it's a hope, and to the extent that we're co-creators, we can strive for it, but I don't think there is a guarantee.
That you can do that.
So the comment is that, you know, when there's that sort of introductory piece that goes into some dissonance, that sometimes if that is too short or not strong enough, that it can be a mistake, whereas when it's promoted and when it's held forth for longer, that it's recognized to be an intentional part of the music, and that by promoting those individual things that we can make that recognition more public. Oh, thanks, I think that's a good comment.
I'm a percussionist, and so there isn't necessarily resolution, but there's satisfaction in providing rhythm for the music. So that's how I feel comfortable.
That's a great comment. I love it. Percussion doesn't always have the idea of resolution, but there's a rhythm that can be provided. I love it.